Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
Plus, you can always listen to all of our episodes, old and new, on the Broadway Podcast Network, iTunes, and Spotify.
It's hard to think of the greatest music directors working on Broadway without thinking of today's guest. You have heard his incredible work for over 30 years, and you might have even seen him on stage in the original Merrily We Roll Along, Masterclass, and Curtains.
And you heard his work in such musicals as The Visit, The Scottsboro Boys, one of my favorites, Sondheim on Sondheim, Curtains, The Look of Love, Ragtime, A Class Act, Steel Pier, and The World Goes Round, to name just a few.
Just a few, folks, to tell us what it was like to work with such legends as John Kander, Fred Ebb, Stephen Sondheim, Hal Prince, John Doyle, Susan Stroman, and so many others. Here is the maestro himself and a fantastic author in his own right, the wonderful David Loud. David, thanks so much for talking with us. And let's just jump right in. As someone who's been such an influential music director and musician, I'd love to know, what sort of records were you listening to when you were growing up?
Well, like every middle-class American family, we had My Fair Lady. We had Guys and Dolls. We had South Pacific. We had Brigadoon. We had Oklahoma. We had Carousel. We even had The Most Happy Fella, which came on a three-disc set.
Good choice, good choice.
Right, yeah.
Not the normal single disc. We had some slightly more obscure musicals like Plain and Fancy. That was an odd one that we had. The Amish musical.
Yeah, totally.
And I remember a recording of Goldilocks. Why we had that, I do not know, but...
Uh-oh. One of my favorite scores, David. Honestly, it's one of my all-time favorite scores. It's so funny.
But we had Barbara Bertie, West Side Story, as well, and The Music Man.
Were you listening to any sort of popular music at the same time as well, or were you just immersed into this theatrical world?
I was not aware of pop music.
Oh, good. You're in the right place.
My family didn't really enjoy it. I liked The Carpenters. That's about the only pop album I had. And I remember when the cast album of Jesus Christ Superstar came out, that was... Oh. Shocking and transgressive and exciting to see, something like a musical theater story being told with this kind of music. That was amazing to me.
Yeah.
And what did your folks do for a living?
They're both teachers.
Did you think that might be the world you would go into first, or
never.
Did you never?
No, I wanted to do musical theater, not as a teacher. I've ended up as a teacher, and I have to say I love it.
Right.
And it sort of rescued me.
When did you first start playing the piano? Did you have formal lessons, or did you just sit down and want to play by ear?
I had formal lessons starting when I was six from a wonderful teacher, Miss Korn, in Cincinnati, who talked way above my head and gave me lessons that I didn't realize the worth of for years and years and years. But, great teachers can do that. They can plant something in your head that long after the fact will suddenly fall into place and make sense. Right. Yeah. She did that for me.
Were you able to play by ear, or do you need that music right in front of you?
No, I'm not one of those sit down at the piano and play the song you've just heard once perfectly on the piano. I can work anything out, but I'm a great sight reader. I process music more classically than by ear. Mm-hmm. That's a whole fascinating thing that I would love to explore at some point.
Oh yeah.
That range of ways that people process music.
Right.
So
right.
Interesting and different.
Now, where did you go to college?
I went to Yale undergraduate for music.
And why Yale, besides it being probably the best school in the United States?
But well, it's one of the best schools in the United States. That was one of the reasons, but also because it was close to New York.
Ah, perfect. And
I wanted to have the access to theater.
Do you remember the first Broadway show you saw?
Oh, my God, of course. Ah. It was The Magic Show.
Oh, wow.
What?
And
I think it is possibly still the greatest thing I've ever seen.
Yes, yes.
I remember every second of it. It had an amazing score. It had an amazing cast.
Mm.
And what I loved about it was that was when the music and the magic and the story all coalesced into one thing. And I mean, the song from the sexy woman who's always conjured up by magicians. You know, she's in the middle of a shower. She's talking to her friends, and boom, there she is in some lechy musician's magic act. That was so funny to me. that a woman would, just because she was so pretty, would end up, on stage somewhere, that having been conjured up.
I love that score. Okay, so you saw The Magic Show. Do you remember any other musicals you saw during this time that were also pretty impactful for you?
There was a review called Rodgers and Hart that I saw.
Oh.
Which, that was new for me. I hadn't experienced something like that before, with no plot.
Yeah.
Sort of sexy people coming on stage and standing and singing songs.
Yeah.
I remember David Carroll was part of that.
He's one of my, we love talking about him because he's one of my favorite voices. I mean, just truly sensational.
Yeah, that was such a loss.
Yeah.
Shenandoah.
Oh, yes.
I loved it. It was like sort of like an ersatz Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Now, were you performing at Yale?
I was thinking of being an actor, but not incredibly seriously. I wasn't majoring in theater. I was majoring in music. But I had worked as a messenger at Variety.
Oh.
For 2 summers. And all the casting notices used to be in Variety.
Yeah.
And Variety, because I had worked there, I had a free subscription to it. And it would come to my Yale post office box every week, rolled up in the box. And I would look at it and sort of wonder about professional theater. And then there was a casting notice for looking for 14 to 20-year-olds to be in Merrily We Roll Along, a new musical to be directed by Harold Prince, written by Stephen Sondheim and George Firth. And I thought, well, that's why I went to Yale, so that I could be close to New York and take the train in and go to
an
open call, which has, of course, absolutely no likelihood of resulting in me being in a Broadway show, but how could I not try?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I had read Moss Hart's Act One, and it had sort of clarified for me what I needed to do, which was to go to New York, to be in the theater, to apprentice myself for whatever.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, totally.
I could do. And this play, Merrily We Roll Along, was based on a play by Moss Hart and Georges Kaufman. I was 18.
Oh, my God.
When I auditioned.
Okay, so you took
during my sophomore year.
You took the train into New York.
Train into New York. In Grand Central Station, I found a photo booth and snapped a 4-inch by 4-inch photo of myself, which I paperclipped to the back of the resume I had typed up the night before. I had been in The Crucible playing Giles Corey, who is like an 80-year-old man. And I had been in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, playing Linus. So, of course, I was going to be cast in a Broadway show.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Naturally.
And, that day I spent online with hundreds of other people, since all of Equity turned out, trying to look between 14 and 20.
Was it at a Broadway theater? Were you outside?
It was actually at the Minskoff Rehearsal Studios.
Ah, yep.
And the line went out the door and through Schubert Alley.
Mm-hmm. What did you sing?
I didn't actually sing that day. I was so far back in the line that I wasn't seen, but this kindly casting assistant came out and collected resumes from those of us who had waited all day. And 2 weeks later, I got a call in my dorm room from Joanna Merlin, Hal Prince's casting woman saying, would you like to audition for Marilyn, would you roll along? And I said, yes, I would very much. And then I had about 3 months of auditions where I would, every 2 weeks or so, I would go into New York and sing for Hal and Paul Gimignani and Joanna Merlin and Sondheim. And I would sing Tonight at 8. And then I would go to the piano and sing another song, Opus 1. Yeah. And they would smile and ask me a question. And I would go back to Yale. And 2 weeks later, I'd do it again. And it went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. Sometimes we would audition on the set of Evita.
Oh.
Hal's show, which was running at the time, which was nightmarish because there were light boxes set in the floor and the stage was raked and I thought it was going to fall into the pit.
What a heady time for you. You're in college and you're commuting for these callbacks.
It was amazing. I felt so special.
Yeah.
And I didn't tell anybody about it either. It was just like my private little secret. And because I knew that the ending was going to be that I wouldn't get it. But I kept getting a little further and a little further. And the fact that I played the piano was very helpful.
Right.
Because they needed, at least two of the actors had to play the piano. Finally, it came down to a day when there were 90 of us at the beginning of the day. And at the end of the day, there were 23 of us left. And we were in a room with Hal Prince. And he said, the show has been cast and you were it.
Oh my God.
And I was a big Sondheim fan already. I had discovered his musicals through albums. I had seen Sweeney Todd, you know, the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. Mm. I actually saw Sweeney Todd sitting next to Michael Cerveris because we were both at the same high school.
What was it like meeting Mr. Sondheim for the first time?
Well, you know, it's pretty much like meeting God.
Yeah. Great.
So, you know, you really aren't yourself in that situation. It took me so many years till I relaxed. You know, I was so lucky over the years to work with him repeatedly. We did a revival of Company together. We did a revival of Pacific Overtures I worked on with him. Mm-hmm. I did Sondheim on Sondheim. And he had always loomed so large in my list of mentors and heroes. And it just took me too long to settle down and realize that he was just a person. And a very kind and thoughtful person. I mean, he was so nice to me always. And at that moment where I was first proposed to him as a music director, and he only knew me as like being one of the Merrily kids,
right.
I thought, well, he's never going to go for this. He was thrilled that I was music directing a revival of Company. And every single time I came back to work with him, he was always just so welcoming, and I was just so honored to be his comrade. working on shows.
What lesson do you think he's taught you that you still take with you to this day?
The more specific your work is, the more universal it can be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one of the great things about his art. It is so specific. He works so hard to get the right detail, the right turn of phrase that reveals everything about a character. The way his lyrics sit on the music is so crafted yet so easy. He says God is in the details, and I think that's a great lesson for artists.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like getting to work hand in hand with him on Merrily We Roll Along, seeing him day in and day out? What was that experience like?
I was in a state of terror for most of it. You know, I felt much less talented than most of the other actors. They were better singers. They were better dancers. You know, I could play the piano. That was that was the one thing I had up my sleeve. And that proved to be very useful. Mm. And Steve was always very complimentary of my piano playing. And it was a thrill, especially because the show was so flawed and so sort of troubled in previews. We did 5 weeks of previews where they changed the show every single performance we did. Mm. They came in with new lyrics, new staging, new scenes, new thoughts, you know, cuts, changes. And we never said, no, we can't do that, Mr. Prince. We always said, of course we can do that. And yes, we will work on our day off. And yes, we'll learn this new routine. And we were doing the kind of work, I mean, it should be illegal. It was like a sweatshop.
Yeah.
We were working so hard. Because the giants of the industry were grappling with this complicated, messy musical that audiences were hating when we started previews. And it really did get better and better and better and better and better. And the honor of watching those great people grapple with the material every day was, I mean, the most valuable class I've ever had in,
right,
you know, how to fix a troubled musical.
What are some of the lessons that you learned from that process you still take with you today?
What they had to do was clarify what the show was about. Mm. And a lot of that meant cutting down the smaller parts and focusing on the leads. When Merrily was originally written, the smaller parts all had little verses and songs, and there's all sorts of little small characters that really had a life in the way that the original play also has many more characters than just the leads. You're constantly meeting interesting people as you go back in time in the original play. And in the musical, they'd sort of done that, but it got confusing. Like, who is this really about? Mm. So the smaller parts were cut away, and it was focused much more clearly on Frank, Mary, and Charlie.
When you were in the rehearsal process, did you think it was going to be a hit, or did you go, something doesn't seem right here?
I was so naive and so thrilled to be there. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I didn't know when people were leaving during the first act that we weren't connecting with the audience. Mm. But I still thought the show was fantastic. I still thought the music was fantastic. And it got so much better that I thought it got great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. By the time we opened. And it's very artificial, the audience response around opening night. And, you know, they were standing and cheering, and the show was playing like it was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
On opening night. And then we read those reviews, and it was like, oh my God, we were the scum of the earth.
Right. Mm.
But the day after we closed, we recorded the cast album.
Right.
And the show has never died since then. You know, the album really was able to prove to the world that it's a great score.
Yeah.
I don't think they've ever gotten it quite right. And everybody thinks they know how to fix it.
Totally.
Yes, yes.
And I always say, I'm sure that this production will be the one that fixes it.
Yeah. Wait, so you just went right back to school. Did you think for a minute you might stay in New York because you had this, your Broadway debut?
Oh, I was so sad.
Yeah.
But I did want to, I was so sad when it closed. And, you know, I had thought I'd be out of college for 2 years doing the
follow-up.
And I called Yale and said, can I come home? And I was back in January. Mm. Having missed one semester. That was all right, too. I mean, Yale was fantastic. And I realized at the end of Merrily that I wasn't an actor and that the person who I really wanted to be was Paul Gimignani down in the pit.
Yes.
He was the music director, and he was this powerful force that just took our attention and made us sing as one and made us focus. And we were kind of terrified of him, too. But I could tell that underneath all that gruff exterior, there was a warm artistic heart that was a wonderful musician. And I watched him conduct Merrily, and I thought, that really is where I belong. That's what I need to be doing. Mm. And so I shifted my focus, and I started applying to, you know, summer stock theaters to work as a music director or assistant music director, and just sort of changed my focus to that.
And did you go to summer stock? I mean, did you, what?
I did. I worked at the Surf.
I would love to hear some.
Surflight was 12 shows in 12 weeks, no days off.
That's all.
That's all. And I did it for 2 summers. So I learned 24 scores doing that. And that's 24 scores from the inside out, like really learning how the vocal arrangements work, how the dance arrangements are constructed, how they move from dialogue to song to dance. And that was a great set of lessons as well. So most of the shows were pretty awful at Surflight, but every now and then everything would come together.
In that one week of rehearsals.
And, you know, if the director was right and all of a sudden it was cast right. And for those shows, you could really feel the audience going, well, this might be good. Mm-hmm. And they'd get really quiet, and you could feel the kind of willing the actors to be better. And
step it up.
Step it up, yeah.
Now, were you living in New York at this time? So were you commuting from New York to wherever the summer stock gig was?
That was actually while I was finishing up at Yale. I did that while I was at Yale. And then I moved back to New York in 1984.
And was your family supportive of all of this?
They didn't know what hit them, really.
Okay.
My parents never stood in the way of what I was doing. And they always were sort of surprised, but permissive with me, you know, focusing so heavily on music and theater. And when I called them to say, you know, I'm thinking of dropping out of Yale and joining the circus with Merrily, they were like, okay, whatever you think.
Yeah.
And I dropped out of Yale and moved to New York without a contract also.
Oh, oh wow.
I mean, we didn't get our contracts till like right before it started. But how could I not have done that?
No, of course. Trust your gut. So when you go back to New York, how do you start making a name for yourself within the New York theatrical right. community?
Well, that's a hard thing to do. And the way it happened for me is the way it usually happens, which is somebody you work with on some strange show somewhere bonds with you, and suddenly they need a pianist or they need a music director or they need you, and they ask for you. And you sort of rise up with the people who you work in at places like Surflight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the crappy little jobs that you think are dead end are not dead end because of the people who are doing them with you.
Yeah.
Right.
And Scott Ellis and I were cast in a play called Billy Bishop Goes to War that we did up at the Portland Stage Company in Portland, Maine. It's a two-character play for an actor who plays 18 parts, no costume changes, and a pianist who's on stage with him the whole time, accompanying the scenes and singing the occasional duet. And Scott was brilliant in the part. It was the last thing he did as an actor. And we had so much fun together. We had a ball sort of figuring out how to make this weird play work with only one actor. And, you know, through his body language, through his voice, and also through the underscoring, we could tell the audience which character was speaking and which one was entering. Mm. And the audience really believed that there were three or four people on stage having a scene together when it was clear that there was only one actor wow. and somebody playing the piano. Because Scott believed, I mean, Scott just had that childlike belief in what he was doing. And if he said that the chair that he was sitting on was a World War I fighting plane, he believed it, so the audience believed it. Anyway, we were very successful up in Portland, and then it was a time that regional theaters were completely broke, and they would cancel their production of As You Like It and book us in, because we were only two people, yeah. a chair and a piano.
Yeah.
And we toured for like 2 years doing that play very successfully all around the country. And then Scott decided to be a director, and he needed a music director. And that was my career. He gave me five Broadway shows.
What is it about your collaboration that works so well?
We had that thing where I just knew what he wanted all the time. His taste was so clear to me. We had similar taste. We had similar ambitions for the kind of theater we liked. You know, the kind of theater that happens in the audience's imagination, mm-hmm. not necessarily, you know, from big sets and big effects, but what an actor can do is what's really interesting to me. And Scott shared that with me, I think. And just the fact that we've been in every conceivable, possible disaster over those 2 years together.
Yeah, that really gives you your true colors when you're in that.
It bonds you to with a show, because there's always something horrible going wrong.
Totally.
What was the first show that you worked on together as director, music director?
The revival of She Loves Me at the Roundabout, which is just a heavenly experience from day one. It's one of my favorite shows ever. It's beautifully written and so mature and touching and true. The score is just exquisite song after exquisite song. We had a great cast with Judy Kuhn and Boyd Gaines, Sally Mays, Howard McGillen, Lee Wilcoff, Brad Kane, the voice of Aladdin, played Arpad. Gorgeous set designed by Tony Walton, who just passed away.
Yeah.
It was the perfect show for Scott. It's because it's real. It's reality. They're real people selling, you know, perfume and soap and lotions. And he loves digging into the reality of a shop and how it works and what the politics are and what the mechanisms of its work are. It was a very happy run.
How did it come to be? How did you guys get picked for this piece?
You know, I don't know what first attracted it to him, but he brought it to the Roundabout. as a proposing it, that they do it at their off-Broadway space in Times Square. We did it at, it's called the Criterion Center back then. And they just said yes and supported us, and they were great.
Did you work on And the World Goes Round before this with him?
Yes, that was the first off-Broadway show we did together.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about that experience, because that cast album is still one of my favorites. It's the arrangements are fabulous.
Thank you. Scott had done The Rink for Candor and Adam. He was in the cast of The Rink on Broadway, and he had bonded with them. And he had this idea as sort of a calling card to try to get the industry to see him as a director rather than an actor. He wanted to do a review of Candor and Ebb songs where each song would reflect in an interesting way off the song that preceded it and the song that followed it. And we wanted to do it without any dialogue, with just trusting the actors and the songs to make each song sort of be a one-act play that was satisfying beginning, middle, end. So we cast it with extraordinary singer actors. And we started rehearsing, and Candor and Ebb wanted to know what was going on. And they came into rehearsal and, to our surprise, like loved what was happening and wanted to be a part of it. And they wanted to kibitz, and they wanted to tell the actors little secrets about how they had written these songs. And they were so generous that way and so open to what we were doing with the piece. You know, there was none of that, like, well, it has to be this way because it's always been this way.
Right.
That they might have had as I ripped apart their numbers and redid the feels and, you know, changed little things about the musical qualities of the pieces. Mm-hmm. They were so open to that. And it just was a great experience for all of us.
And one of many collaborations eventually for you and them.
Yes. It was during that rehearsal period that John turned to me and said, I'd love you to music direct our next Broadway show.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, okay, I'm available. And I did Steel Pier for them. I did the Scottsboro Boys. I did Curtains and did The Visit.
Yeah.
All on Broadway for Candor and Ebb. And what an honor.
I mean,
work with them. John Candor is the nicest, most sensible, most caring person in the world.
What's it like to collaborate with him as a musician as well? I mean, what's his musicianship like, and how do you collaborate?
He's the best piano player you ever heard.
Yeah.
And he can just sit down at the piano and put his hands on the keys, and out comes music. He says that his brain is a river of music that never stops.
Wow.
And it just comes out his fingers. He doesn't think about it. He doesn't edit it. Right. It just comes. And it's always been that way for him.
Right.
He described writing with Fred. He said, in the same way that he can improvise freely at the keyboard, he said Fred could do that with language.
Mm.
And they would just get in the room together and riff, find the kernel, and then build the song together, just sort of improvising together. They only wrote in the same room, and they never changed their technique.
Right.
And their songs are so cleverly crafted.
Yeah.
And so seemingly simple while being just perfect.
I'm curious, you did She Loves Me, and it was a success, huge success. You know, they did a recording of it. Now, did this open the door at Roundabout to do more productions? Is that how Company came about eventually, or were they connected at all?
Yes, they were absolutely connected, because Scott was the director of both of those. Scott Ellis was, and he got more and more involved with the Roundabout as the years went on. Yeah, She Loves Me was a great experience, and it did lead to doing Company there.
What was your relationship like with Bach and Harnick?
Well, they were delightful. They came to every rehearsal, practically, of the show.
Wow.
Was that nerve-wracking?
I know.
No, not at all. The two of them are just delightful. Bach and Harnick wrote Fiorello. They wrote Fiddler on the Roof. They wrote She Loves Me. They wrote
Apple Tree.
The Apple Tree. And then on a show called The Rothschilds, they argued bitterly and split and never wrote again. So they were divorced. They were clearly divorced when we were working on She Loves Me. And I was just always very aware that they were so hyper aware of each other and never sitting together, but always being very respectful for each other, to each other, very polite. And watching poor Joe Mastroff, the librettist, sort of do the little dance between them reminded me so much of my childhood with my parents. It was sad to see. But they would give the tiniest little notes. You know, perhaps there could be a smaller retard here, that, so we don't lose the energy there, David. Yeah. Little things like that. Pronunciation, phrasing for the chorus. And every note they gave made it sparkle more brightly and move more smoothly. The show is so intricately constructed. I think it's an almost perfect musical.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit then about working with people like Susan Stroman on Steel Pier, which is one of my favorite shows of all time.
Yep.
Steel Pier, the album is so flavorful.
Yes.
It is. The
orchestrations are just sublime.
Tell us what it was like working on crafting the show, specifically conjuring up the era like you just said.
You know, Steel Pier is set in the Depression in, you know, the late 20s, early 30s. And that era of music is so juicy. When you think of the sort of the explosion of jazz and ragtime.
Yes.
And, you know, sort of operetta coming into musical theater and that sense of high melody that you get from shows of that period.
Syncopation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the dancing was very period researched and of the time. And it's like a masterclass on dance styles of the late 20s and early 30s, the choreography for that show. We had the world's best dancers, and they worked so hard. I mean, the show is about a dance marathon. Basically, the whole cast is on stage the whole time dancing, and viruses would go through that company like plague. I mean, they were just constantly sweating on each other and getting sick and coughing on each other, but none of them would ever dream of missing a performance. You know, so they would just infect everybody all again. The images that spring into my head from that show are so beautiful. There's this gorgeous opening where the line of dancers came down from the very back of the stage, like through the mist. And they walked down to the front, looking out at the audience, and they reached into their pockets. They brought out sand, and they let the sand go onto the stage. And it was a beach, and it was maybe the ashes of the fallen pilot that Rita meets at the beginning of the show. And then they would disappear back up into the mist. It was so beautiful. At the end of the show, they did these spot turns in a circle, almost in the dark. It was like this whirlwind of dancers revolving in like a cyclone in the dark that created this passionate sort of wind. And then they would all split to the sides. I've never seen stuff like that before.
Yeah.
And as the conductor, you're right in the middle of it. You're on the podium. It's happening 5 feet away from you. And all the little subplots in Steel Pier, the rivalries between the dancers, between the dance teams, the frustrations, the hopes, the sabotage that they would do to each other, it was all being played out by the dancers in a way that was so much more interesting than what the show was actually doing. Mm-hmm. Down closer to projecting out to the audience. But from where I was, I felt like I was inside this other drama, which was all the subtext that the dancers were creating each night. It was extraordinary.
And why do you think that show was not as successful, per se, as I think maybe we all would like to have been?
Yeah. Well, the score was great. The design was great. The cast was great. The music was great. But the story was not satisfying. The guy was dead. And when you found that out, never seemed to work. Mm. It was originally designed that you would go through the whole story, and then at the end you'd realize he was dead. Then in your mind you'd look back and go, oh, well, now that makes sense, and that makes sense, and that makes sense, and that makes sense. But that didn't seem to work for some reason, and the producers kept saying, you know, we got to find out earlier, we have to know earlier. Finally, the show started with an airplane crash and poor Danny McDonald, like, coming on stage with smoke coming off his costume, and he's trying to be a ghost or something. I don't know what it was. You know, how do you act invisible? How do you act transparent?
Right.
So I think when we opened, the audience was supposed to know from the beginning that he was dead, which is just, I guess, a different way to tell the story. Nothing about it worked. Nothing about that plot worked, really.
But you think it would have been more impactful had at the end of the show, the audience found out he had been deceased?
I think that might have made it better.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I've seen movies like that where you, at the end of The Sixth Sense, you know, when you find out what's really happening, then you can go back in your mind. I think the movie even does that. It shows you all the little things that you didn't understand as they were happening. And I don't know. The audiences did not connect with it, unfortunately.
Well, yeah. Folks, if you've never listened to it, please take a listen to it, because it's a beautiful score. And your work on it, David, is just so fantastic. Mm-hmm. Now, when you begin a show like that, where it's so steeped in a period, do you go and research recordings of that time and then share that with the cast? How does that world work for you?
You know, it's interesting. I asked Kander, when he was writing Cabaret, he did a lot of research about Weimar music and what the German music was like at that time. And he said no, he did not. He had an idea of what he felt about that music. And he certainly knew a lot about Kurt Weill and maybe other contemporary composers at that time. But he said, I don't want to be doing a dissertation. I want to make a score. And so he wrote his take on that time without pedantically imitating styles of the time.
Right.
And of course, what you get is the flavor of the time with the craft of what is still a true John Kander song.
Exactly.
And I feel the same way. I mean, research is great, and I think we should explore and we should know everything about our source material and all that, but you don't want to get out of the theater and into the museum.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
Can you lead us through what a typical rehearsal day is like for you, or how you begin the process of teaching music to the actors?
To me, that's the most important step in the entire process. How you teach the music is everything, because it's going to affect the way the actor sings that music for the rest of the run. And I try to work as slowly as possible, getting the music into the cast's brains in the way that I want from the beginning, so that we always know we're going to breathe here. This consonant is important. This one is not important. Trying to just get all the information into them, because as soon as they start dancing around,
acting,
saying their lines and acting, all that's going to go out the window.
Right.
If you don't really know it. So I try to teach the score as precisely as I can. And then I like to do a sing-through of the show before they're on their feet, so that we just have this memory of what the score is trying to be. Because then it all falls apart. It all goes to shit. Nobody knows where the cutoffs are. Nobody is singing together, because they're acting and dancing, and that's the way it should be. But the rest of my rehearsal process is trying to get the score back to the way it was when we sang it around the piano before all the other people started fucking it up.
That is so brilliant.
And I know it's hard to worry about your cutoffs when, you know, you're pirouetting or sobbing or whatever it is you're doing is getting in the way. But we got to get it on 4, so fuck up.
Hello, this is Betty Davis. Not the young one, the old one. I've been on matches.com looking for a gentleman who might like to date an actress who loves to smoke and who had a black and white career. And I thought, why am I wasting my money on this when I could merely donate it to those boys at Behind the Curtain? Go to patreon.com and give all you can. God knows they need it. And do it before you're 122 years old. That's Patreon.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary, and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Has there ever been a time where you had an idea of what you thought the song should be, and then a performer came into the room and rehearsed it with you, and you realized, oh, wow, it could be something totally different?
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that the most thrilling thing that ever happens?
Yes. Oh, God, yes. Yes.
When an actor comes in and shows you new possibilities in a song, that is the best thing ever. Mm. I pray for that. You know, I call it actor magic. When you work on a song with somebody and they're doing it exactly the way you want them to do it, they go away, they work on it themselves, they come back, all of a sudden it's theirs. Mm. And maybe they're not doing exactly what you said, but they've figured out why it has to be this way.
Right.
And if the actor magic is strong, you know, it can reveal things in a score that you never thought were there.
Can you think of a performer, and I know you've worked with lots of geniuses, that when they walk into a rehearsal room with you, you get excited, a smile goes on your face, because you know it's going to be a fun collaboration?
Certainly Karen Ziemba.
Oh, the best. The best.
Yeah. Karen can do anything and has never failed at anything she's attempted to do. She's just the best, and she knows in her bones what it should be. You don't have to tell her what it should be. She knows. She's just one of those instinctive people. Marin Mazzie was like that.
Oh.
You never had to tell Marin what to do. She just knew. And it was never storm and drong with her either. She just was always perfect. She could be anything. She could be, you know, Hollywood glamour. She could be the girl next door. She could be Nordic ice princess. She could be wacky storyteller.
When did you first meet her?
Marin replaced Karen Mason in the off-Broadway run of And the World Goes Round. And Karen Mason was great, but Karen Mason has sort of a dark take on the world. And Marin is sunshine and light. And it was so interesting to see those same songs change so much. Like Marin's Colored Lights was this triumph at the end, whereas Karen was raging against the world at the end of it. Marin's Ring Them Bells was the funniest thing you'd ever heard. And Karen's was just like the weirdest story you've ever encountered.
That must be exciting to you, though, as a conductor.
Absolutely. Yeah. Working with Brian Stokes Mitchell was like that in Ragtime. It was just thrilling to see what that man could do with his voice. And of course, Audra, who I got the privilege of working with on three shows.
Yes.
Masterclass, Ragtime, and Porgy and Bess. Mm-hmm. She can do anything.
Anything
vocally, anything acting-wise. She's just astonishing.
Yeah.
As a music director, what note would you say you find yourself giving more than any other note?
Triple your diction.
Triple your diction. I love that. Yeah. The lyric is very important to you, isn't it?
From the very first moment of the show. If you can't hear it, you can't get it.
In auditions, you've been to, and you've sat through so many auditions. Is that what you look for in an audition as well? What are you looking for?
Yes, I do look for that. But really in an audition, what I look for is, can this person tell a story? That's what we're praying for behind the table, is a story that exists in a song. And poor actors are always so nervous in auditions that so often that element of the piece floats away from them. And they're just focused on recreating what they did the last time they sang it in their voice lesson. Right. Or whatever. And really what you want is a story. And when it happens, the whole room lights up and everybody starts writing, like, the person's name. We must have this person in our show. It's great to see when an actor can actually do that in an audition.
What is your relationship like with a sound designer once a show moves into the theater?
It's such a complicated question.
Give us a complicated answer.
As a music director, I have to balance the show from the way I can hear it on the podium. I'm going to balance the orchestra in a way that supports the voices without overwhelming them. And in a way, all of my work is in the hands of the sound designer, because it's the sound designer's job to translate what I hear on the podium to the entire theater, which is very difficult. The older Broadway theaters, of course, were designed not to need electronic amplification.
Yep.
And when I'm in one of those theaters, I try to do at least an afternoon or an hour or something where we test the acoustics of the space without any amplification and then build up from that to see what we need.
Oh, interesting.
But anyway, all of my work is in the sound designer's hands, and that can be really frustrating if the sound designer isn't tasteful and instinctive and a storyteller as well. Got to be part of the team and telling the same story as the rest of us.
Right. What do you find to be the biggest gap between what you want and what a sound designer wants, if that makes sense? You know, where do you find yourself having the most conversation with the sound designer?
Well, it's very tempting to just make things louder.
Yeah.
And make the voices louder, and then everybody's happy because everybody can hear everything. And that's not always the best goal in the world. I try to bring out lots of dynamics in a score when I'm working on it. I try to have the actors work softly with clarity and loudly with clarity so that we have all of that variety. If somebody's just loud all night through everything they're saying, it's not interesting. It can get very wearing. You want colors. You want gradations. And the sound designer can erase that.
Just by putting everything at a loud level. Yeah.
Right. No color.
That's very frustrating. And you want the orchestra to be present, but not overwhelming. And finding that exact balance is challenging also.
And then this is because I don't have the knowledge of this. How do you check the balance when you're up at that podium? How do you hear what's going on in the back of the house?
Well, I try usually to have my assistant conduct a little bit and go out and hang with the sound designer and hear what they're hearing and give my response to it. Ultimately, I have to trust that they're going to be enough of an artist to fulfill my vision. I can't do it. I don't know about all the little levers and the chords and the...
Sure.
Right.
So it's a real act of trust.
And what do you look for out of an assistant? Uh-oh.
Everything in the world.
Great.
Must play piano like nobody else in the world. Must transpose. Must always be smiling. Must be happy to work, in the sweat mines.
Yes.
It's funny because it's true.
I had such great assistants, who have gone on to be wonderful music directors themselves. People like Sam Davis. Andy Einhorn.
Andy.
And they're all so talented.
Got a good group of proteges there.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more in depth, if we can, about your relationship with Stephen Sondheim and bringing his work to life. Was Company the first one together, besides Merrily, where we know you were an actor?
We had done Merrily, and then when I first moved to New York, I got a job in the pit of a revival of Pacific Overtures that Franz Schroeder had directed at the York Theater Company.
Yes.
And it was a wonderful revival. Very small, where the original had been, huge. This was a much more intimate look at the story, and it worked perfectly well. Mm-hmm. And Pacific Overtures was... just so exotic and strange and funny and profound. The lyrics are so simple in places and so fiendishly clever in others. There's a haiku-like simplicity, although he was never really writing haikus. But he also finds extraordinary humor, and there's wonderful pastiche in the score. You know, he's imitating other styles.
Right.
Like the five generals coming, all demanding ports. And the British general is Gilbert and Sullivan.
Gilbert Patterson. Sullivan. Yes.
The American general is this, Susamar. Mm-hmm. The French is this Offenbach Can-Can. The guy from Russia is doing this Chardash. And the Dutch guy is doing this ridiculous waltz clog.
Yes. It's
so funny. I love that number. So I worked on that. I was the assistant, and I played in the orchestra. And Eric Stern, who was the music director, went away and did something else at the end, and I conducted. And Steve saw me conduct, and I was very nervous, and he thought it was great. That was all very positive. And then, we did Company together. And on Company, we had this day where the cast knew the score, and Steve came in, and we sang through the score, and he coached every single number.
Oh.
And it was fantastic. He's such a good coach of his own material, and he just dives in and does the work, and everybody's shitting themselves, of course, because it's not fun. But they were adults, and they bucked up and took the notes and asked the questions, and it was a great day. I felt like he really just unlocked so many questions that the cast had stored up, and I try to pass on, whenever I work on the material from Company, I try to pass on those things that he told us that day.
Do you remember some of them?
A lot of it was finding where the song's climax.
Oh.
Where is the climax of the song here? Why are you building so much when you still have so far to go? Was a lot of the work that day, I remember. Making sure that Joanne doesn't have to scream until she gets to the big scream in Ladies Who Lunch. Finding a way to make the build in the opening number exciting so it wasn't just Bobby at the same volume for the entire number. Finding ways to vary the intention so that the volume could be different.
Right.
As the song was going on.
How much of it as a music director are you also helping with the acting? I mean, I know the answer to this, obviously, and I know what your answer, but I'm just would like, because there are some people that think, oh, I just do the notes on the page, that's it, and it ends there. Can you talk a little bit about how the storytelling is very much a part of what your job is?
I take great liberties in that department. I believe that my responsibility is not just the singing of the song, it's the acting of the song, and it's the acting of the character in the song. And I give more notes, I think, about diction and character and development than most music directors would dare. And some directors don't like that. And some resist that, but not the good ones.
Yeah.
I try to be very collaborative. And if that means going over to Susan Stroman and saying, you know what, I think this might be better if musically we did this here, and that's going to affect the dancing. That may not be exactly what she wants to hear, but she's enough of an artist to at least consider my request. Right. And often, say, of course, you're absolutely right. Let's do that. I think it's very important that dancers, when they're singing, have their heads facing the audience. And some composers don't always supply that. I mean, some choreographers don't always supply that.
Right.
And that's a conversation that I am not afraid to have. It's hard enough to understand people's lyrics. If there's dancing and the heads are away from the audience, your chances of getting the lyrics are even smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, things like that, I feel, are well within the purview of the music director.
Indeed.
What happens when a director says, David,
shut up.
Shut up. You're crossing a line.
Well, how do you get upset.
Okay, great.
I would get very upset in that case and have to figure out what I would want to do about it.
So what have you been in a situation like that before?
Not really in a serious way. I mean, it's all about reading the room.
Yes.
There's certainly times when it would be the worst idea in the world for me to butt in with my opinions. But there's always a time that, I can bring it up, hopefully.
Who are some of the directors that you've really enjoyed working with? I mean, I know you've talked about Scott Ellis, and I know you've talked about Stroh, but who else is in that list where you go, yes, I'll drop anything to go work with you?
Frank Galati.
Tell us more.
Frank did Ragtime. And also the first two incarnations of The Visit. that I did. Frank did it at the Goodman and at the Signature in D.C. And working with Frank Galati is sort of like working with Santa Claus combined with the Pope. He is the most brilliant storyteller and articulate inspirer of people. Note sessions with him are like a graduate school in comparative literature and theatrical tropes. He's so smart and he's so giving with his knowledge. You just feel like you feel cleaner and smarter after talking with him. He had a great visual sense, but on Ragtime, I think what made it work with that collaboration was that he had Graziella Danielle, who knows the mechanics of staging and can make anything happen on stage technically, so that Frank could just sort of step back and be the big picture guy. And he was the nice one. And he could be that way because Garth was the mean one. Garth was the one who could say, this song sucks and you gotta write a better one for tomorrow. Which Frank would never say. But Garth could say that.
Wow.
And so they go away and they write a better song. And that's not always the case in the show. There isn't always somebody who can say that. And it's one of the things that made Ragtime so great, I think, that Garth didn't give a shit about your feelings.
Right.
He told the truth. And Frank could make you feel better. But Garth would say, you know, not in my theater.
A little good cop, bad cop. Okay.
Right.
David, this we usually ask this as our last question. And so what do you know now that you wished you had known back in 1981 when you first were coming to the city and starting your career?
Be yourself is the lesson that I think we all learn in the business eventually. You can't be pretending to be somebody else. You have to do the work to figure out who you are, what you want to say, and then how you're going to say it. You can't be anybody else. You can only be you. I think that's true of actors. I think that's true of musicians. I know it's true of directors. Anybody can smell when somebody is pretending or lying or in some way not being who they really truthfully are. And it's so much easier, ultimately, to present your true self in your work. It's the hardest thing in the world to do. I think we all have things about ourselves that we are embarrassed about and don't like or are ashamed of or have been taught to be ashamed of. And sometimes those are the best things about you. Mm-hmm. The interesting things, the quirky things.
Yeah. I love that. What a great way to end. Yeah. That is words to live by. David, it has been such a joy getting to talk to you today. And on behalf of myself and Kevin and all of our listeners, thank you for providing us with so many beautiful musical moments over the past 30 plus years.
What a nice thing to say. Thank you.
Truly, yeah, thank you.
Seriously. Friends, please make sure to buy a copy of David's fantastic book, Facing the Music. If you click into our link in our show description today, it'll take you over to Amazon where you can go and purchase it. It's fantastic. David, I hope that we get to meet in person someday so we can shake your hand and say thank you for all the beauty you have given us.
I would love that. You guys are so energetic.
Thank you.
Here.
All right, friends, until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode, and a big thanks to the punchy players Jeff Marquis, who is bringing back Lucy, Betty, Judy, and Morta shill for us.
And a big thanks to our sound editor Daniel Schwartzberg and social media manager Bethany Ann Selecki.
And don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you come in.
In order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us just 1 star and you can make us feel as bad as Annie did in that really weird production in Boston where Annie dreamt that she was being adopted, but then she ended up back in the orphanage, right back where she started. Yeah, true story. Rob saw it.
Yes, and it was Betty. It was bizarre. I was there. I was.
Oh, good.
So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.